This is The Cable.
Big bid on 10-year treasuries over the last week. Tech story is front and centre.
A lot of people are saying, no thank you, step back. You're saying, get in, why?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets. The dollar, a little bit stronger today. This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable.
An historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
With Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good afternoon to the City of London. You are listening to The Cable live across the capital on DAB Digital Radio. It has just gone 5 p.m. in the city alongside Guy Johnson in London. I'm Jonathan Ferro here in New York. The next couple of days are going to be absolutely fascinating, Guy, with the ECB tomorrow and payrolls Friday just around the corner.
So I thought the ECB was interesting today. The meeting starts today, we get the announcement tomorrow, but you saw the Bloomberg scoop a little earlier on suggesting the staff projections are going to include a significant downgrade both to the inflation outlook and also to the growth outlook, sufficient enough to probably generate an announcement on a Teltro. The market's knee-jerk reaction was buy banks, sell the euro. That didn't last long, which I guess tells you the market's already got it priced.
Yeah, and potentially it won't be enough. And that's the big issue, isn't it, going into tomorrow. The question was always, to what degree would those forecasts be cut? It was never, will they or won't they? Quite clearly, they're going to be cut sizably, enough to make them sit around the table and consider what's next. But Guy, what's next was always limited. The policy options were always thin. And I think most market participants have looked at the situation in Europe and assumed there's not much ammunition left at the European Central Bank.
No, probably not much ammunition. What I think is most stunning, though, is that the ECB is anticipating that it is going to get a bounce back to trend growth in the second half of the year. Judging by the recent data, that's a pretty big stretch. We'll talk about that in a moment. We'll come back to the ECB story. In the meantime, we should probably get some headlines. Charlie Pellett, over to you.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. A gloomy report this morning from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It says the global economy is suffering more than expected from trade tensions and political uncertainty, which are clouding prospects, particularly in Europe. As this is the organization's first forecast in almost 4 months, it is partly playing catch-up with developments since then. In the United States, another lousy day for shares of General Electric after the new CEO's sobering outlook reminded investors that the company's troubles are far from over. J.P. Morgan Chase has said its estimate of $6 a share, the lowest on Wall Street, might be overly generous. GE down again today by 6%. And Deutsche Lufthansa may be, quote, very interested in bidding for EasyJet. This according to analysts at Kepler Cheuvreux, who say a takeover would be a good fit and should overcome regulatory hurdles. Latest from the news desk, Jonathan Ferro, back to you. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to you as well. Charlie Pellett, thank you very much. Michael Hewson joining us, Chief Market Analyst for CMC Markets over in London. Michael, good to catch up with you once more. Interesting, the story that Guy tells about the prospect of stimulus or whatever you want to call it, another round of loans at the ECB tomorrow. Didn't get much bang in the market, with the exception of maybe one place, the Italian 10-year yield down about 11 or 12 basis points on a session. Decent bid coming into bunds. Is that going to help, Mike?
How is that good, though, for banks? It's just going to flatten the yield curve even further and push it more into negative territory. I do not see, by any stretch of the imagination, how that is good for Eurozone banks. Because also, what it also does, it just acknowledges the fact that ultimately, despite all of Mr. Draghi's entreaties over the past 12 months that the slowdown is temporary and that at some point you'll get a rebound, and Guy touched upon it earlier, we're still seeing significant weakness in the Eurozone economy. And yes, you can argue that services has shown a little bit of a pickup in Spain and Germany, but ultimately it just tells me that the same problems that have, I think, caused the slowdown in Europe are still there.
I guess the argument will be that some of this money was going to roll off, Michael, and as a result of which you would kind of get a tightening within the financial system as a result of that. In some ways, you could argue that simply putting a Teltro back into the market is simply maintaining the status quo. That's kind of what it feels like at the moment. I guess they're kind of just playing for time here.
But it doesn't mean that they're going to announce a new one. All they can do is they should just renew the ones that are rolling off in June.
Well, I guess they may see it as a new one effectively.
Yeah.
Whether or not the funding structure is the same, I don't know.
It's spinning. I suppose it's a way of spinning it. I mean, you've got to look at the core inflation rate. They're going to downgrade that, I would imagine, quite significantly. If you look at the core inflation rate in Europe, it hasn't really been above 1.2% since April 2013. Now, I don't see any evidence whatsoever that it's going to really move much above that. In fact, it actually went lower in the last set of numbers, even if the headline rate did tick up slightly. So they do have a significant problem, but I'm not really sure it's in the ECB has the capacity or the capability to do anything about it, apart from continue to just try and keep liquidity flowing. These problems can't be resolved by the European Central Bank.
So, Mike, you're the ECB, you're on the Governing Council, you're in that meeting, perhaps you're having the meal together later this afternoon going into the meeting tomorrow. You've seen the story out there in the public that the forecasts are going to get dropped aggressively. You know that yourself because you've seen them. You've seen also how financial markets have responded to the prospect of another round of loans. Are you satisfied?
Not really, because I don't think it's had the desired effect. As Guy said, to a certain extent, I think it's discounted in the price, but I certainly think that they probably want the euro to go an awful lot lower than it actually
is.
It
makes me wonder what they can do tomorrow, then.
I just think that they continue to peddle the story that they were starting to turn. They've started to change the narrative ever so slightly in January. In November, Draghi was talking about the fact that he thought the slowdown was temporary. In January, he's moved the narrative slightly by saying that policymakers said the shift in outlook had clearly moved to the downside. So I think if they were to signal a teltro now, it would be tantamount to admitting that actually terminating the asset purchase program at the end of December was a mistake. So what they think they could argue is that they keep their options open for implementing a teltro in June.
They're just buying time, aren't they?
Yeah,
I guess they're hoping that what they described as temporary is just that, but the evidence is mounting up that it increasingly isn't a temporary slowdown.
I think it's structural, Guy. I think it's structural. And Mr. Draghi, I mean, you can copy and paste an awful lot of the statement that he makes. Every meeting he talks about structural reforms within the euro area. They need to move at a faster pace. But ultimately, he is not going to get the rate rise he wanted. And the big problem is when the Governing Council changes president later this year, is whoever replaces him is going to have exactly the same problem. And the big concern that I have is that any new incumbent is not going to be as flexible in interpretation of monetary policy.
Well, we raised this on this program just yesterday, Mike. I'd love your insight on it. Draghi's successor. Will President Draghi be wary about tying the hands of his successor?
I don't think
he can. Or will
he
actively look to tie the hands of his successor?
I don't see how he can, because ultimately the ECB president is but one voter on the Governing Council.
But you can come to a conclusion, a consensus on the Governing Council right now.
You can.
To have a new version of forward guidance that essentially goes beyond Draghi's term and to some extent ties the hands of the new president.
I'm not sure how he can do that and make it legally binding.
Well, it wouldn't be legally binding. It would just be make it complicated to get out of.
Yeah, but again, he would need to garner a consensus of those same policymakers, one of which who is going to be his successor, unless they parachute someone in from outside. And I don't see that as being particularly likely. And I can't imagine that he'll be able to gain a consensus on the council to do that, knowing full well that he's delivering a poison chalice to his successor, who actually is sitting on the Governing Council right now.
Would
you sign up for that, Guy? If you were sitting on the Governing Council and you potentially in line to be his successor, would you be happy to have your hands tied in that fashion? I know I wouldn't.
I think politics comes into this in such a big way that the chess that is played around all of this is incredibly difficult to manage. I think even if Weidmann was coming in, I think his ability to be as he has been at the Bundesbank, if he were president of the ECB, is a very different phenomenon.
It's much more consensual.
Absolutely. Be interesting to see whether the euro breaks out of its recent very tight range on what happens tomorrow. We will find out. This is The Cable.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable, live across the capital on DAB Digital Radio, alongside Guy Johnson in London. I'm Jonathan Ferro here in New York City. A few hours ago, we got a really interesting data point from the United States. The trade balance, the trade deficit for 2018, widening to a decade wide, a 10-year high, $621 billion. This is what happens when you're a big importing nation and your economy gets stronger. You import even more and the deficit widens. The president's not happy about this. He's looking to do something about it. And you've heard a lot about the trade war with China. Maybe we should gear up for Europe's very own bespoke trade dispute. The New York Times writing the following: the US and the EU are headed for a food fight over trade. Essentially, the narrative that's building up here on the United States is that the US administration is actively looking to use the threat of auto tariffs to open up the agricultural market in Europe to US farmers. Whether this works remains to be seen, but it was interesting today because Ambassador Lighthizer was meeting with the Trade Commissioner of the European Union. Guy, where is this one going?
I don't know, but I think it's interesting that the president has decided that he wants to end the trade story with China because he's worried about the market reaction. I wonder whether or not that will influence his thinking when it comes to potentially starting a new front, though he has recently started smaller new fronts with India and Turkey. But nevertheless, opening up a significant trade war with the Eurozone, with Europe, I think could have a significant market effect that would ultimately cancel out any positives that may be generated from resolving the China issue. Michael Hewson from CMC still with us. Thoughts, Michael?
Well, apparently he's pushing a resolution to the China trade deal because he's worried about the fact that the stock market might be starting to roll over. So why would he then go and pick a fight with Europe, which could have a similarly negative effect? So I'm struggling to square that with the story that he's trying to wind up the dispute with China. For me, it doesn't make sense because if your barometer of success is a high stock market and you think that it's starting to run out of steam, why would you pick a new fight with Europe at precisely the time that you're trying to wrap up the dispute with China?
Campaign politics, and I guess it depends how the campaign politics plays into the election. Cecilia Malmström, the European Trade Commissioner, said last month that this should just cover industrial goods and that's it. This just keeps coming back to the American farmer, Mike.
Well, and the European farmer, because
seemingly
the common
well.
Agricultural policy is jealously defended by the French. So
that's why I find this really interesting. So there's two ways that the president can address the issue with China. There's the structural trade story. So we can have a structural deal that addresses things like technology transfer, forced transfer, IP theft, the theft of intellectual property. Or we can have a trade balance deal, which essentially is just buy more American agricultural goods. Which deal do you think we do get ultimately?
I think the first one, because the agricultural one is just full of pitfalls and vested interests. The French farmers aren't going to give up there are.
I know, I meant for China specifically.
Oh,
sorry,
see,
Mike.
China.
Yeah, not
sorry,
Europe.
I thought
yeah.
we were back on.
I think
it'd
probably
Europe.
Be much easier with the Chinese to do the trade balance one than the structural one.
I think so, but I think, you know, the trade balance one is not being helped by the fact that the US economy got juiced by a whole load of tax cuts in the middle of last year. So there was an awful lot of domestic consumption going on there. And an awful lot of US companies front-loaded their imports to beat the tariffs. And the big problem that they've got at the moment now is the Chinese economy is slowing down at precisely the time that they want to boost their exports. And one thing I did notice about those trade numbers was the December slowdown that we saw in exports as a result of the slowdown that we're seeing in the global economy at the end of the year. So his timing is not great.
Yeah. Timing is everything in life, isn't it? We will continue this conversation, figure out what's coming up next. Michael, great to have you with us on the program today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Michael Hewson joining us from CMC. Coming up next, we're going to hear from Javier Rolle. He is now the CEO of the asset manager / hedge fund CQS. We're going to get his take on where that business is going next. This is Bloomberg. This is The Cable.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. It is 18 minutes past five in the City of London. A man well known to the City of London is Xavier Rolet. He recently took over as the CEO of the UK's CQS. CQS used to be a hedge fund, now much more of an asset manager. Basically, his relationship, which goes back to his Goldman Sachs days in New York with Michael Hintze, is a big part of this transaction. Michael Hintze is going to be, was the former CEO, is now going to be focusing more on the investing side of the business. Now, earlier today, Vonnie Quinn and I spoke to Xavier Rolet to discuss the current investing environment. Mr. Rolet, of course, and Michael Hintze, $18 billion under management. And Mr. Rolet, of course, the former head of the London Stock Exchange.
We think the whole asset management industry, the investment industry, is changing beyond recognition. We could talk a long time about what indices and the passive side of the asset management industry has done to active. We can talk about the relative lack of growth of the hedge fund industry. But we think of ourselves as an investment company, but driven by absolute returns. So that can be encapsulated in a long-only strategy, in a combination of strategies. It's fundamentally about solutions that will enable the biggest asset owners in the world to achieve their investment objectives, to meet their liabilities, to meet basically their internal hurdle rates or discount rates.
Where does CQS think we are in the credit cycle?
That's a very good question. We do think, of course, and the reality is this cycle has been running for a long time, but we still see some potential for this credit cycle to continue. We think the growth environment in the world is improving. Some of the geopolitical deals that are being worked out, sometimes with some temporary difficulties, will add to that upside in the growth environment. So we do think the credit cycle still has a few more years to run.
Just in the last couple of days, though, we've got so many growth downgrades, the ECB, the OECD,
yes.
China. And I know China is, for you, a bellwether for the credit cycle.
Yes.
So tell us more about why you think there's still a good picture for growth out there.
And it's a very good question, because whilst we believe the credit cycle and growth cycle will continue, the picture is mixed. If you look at Europe, for example, in some sectors, distressed will be a big opportunity. The economic recovery that we saw, the fairly tepid economic recovery we saw in the Eurozone 2 years ago, has now essentially flattened out, and monetary policies are likely to be more supportive going forward in a monetary sense. So the EU, in terms of liquidity, I think will see a renewal of central bank action. China is really quite a different a situation, and I spend myself a lot of time there. I think what we heard earlier with your colleague talking about the CSI 300 and the Shanghai Exchange picking up, something really important is happening in China. Of course, you don't expect an economy of that size to grow at 7% forever. But China is looking today at ways in which it could recalibrate its economy towards consumption, towards innovation, and for this, it needs vibrant equity and capital markets. We think the economy, the opportunity in China is very, very substantial. 50% of total assets under management growth last year was in China. So whilst the U.S. remains by and large the largest market in the world with over 55% of all financial assets owned here, growth opportunities, particularly focusing on technology, green debt, there's $1 trillion ESG market in China, means that these opportunities in capital markets and investment are there. The economy is obviously forged ahead, but we're at the stage where capital markets are catching up. And the opportunities, we believe, over the next few years, particularly in mainland China, will be very substantial.
Mr. Rolet, the volatility in China, though, has been extreme. Like, you look
Correct.
At what happened towards the back end of last year. How much sort of volatility will global investors tolerate, given what we've seen in China thus far?
That's a very good question. Last year, the A50 and the Chinese market really were under very severe pressure. And I think those investors that were fully invested in China and have endured the pain will be rewarded this year in China. Something very important is happening. You'll recall that the Chinese government, President Xi, did crack down on what is described as shadow banking and capital market. Those policies are evolving today, and there's definitely a renewed focus on funding innovation, the real economy, small and mid-sized enterprises, scaling up that technology with the help of capital markets. So I think China is making an important decision, is to open up its capital markets to fund growth. which is unfortunately not the decision that historically has been made in Europe, where the economy remains essentially dependent on bank funding and bank debt and has undersized capital markets. So I think this year will be a transformational year potentially in China, and one certainly to look at with a great deal of care for investment opportunities in domestic industries, technology-led industries.
The Capital Markets Union is going nowhere in a hurry at the moment. As you say, Mr. Rowley, Europe relies on the bank channel, particularly SME businesses rely on the bank channel to provide funding. The ECB is expected to deliver another TLTRO tomorrow. Given the kind of capital markets history that you have, would that be a mistake in terms of generating further forward momentum in the capital markets process?
It's a good question. It's a personal view. It seems that the ECB has become not just the first, but the last line of defense in terms of propping up economic growth. There's a structural job deficit of about 20 million in the EU, and there are 23 million small and mid-sized enterprises that could create these jobs. Unfortunately, the fiscal and regulatory framework in Europe is deeply disadvantageous to long-term patient capital, particularly equities. Equity markets represent $40 billion a day in terms of daily turnover throughout the EU. In the US, it's five times that, and China has $500 billion a day. So in my view, Europe needs to urgently recalibrate its fiscal and regulatory regime to give equity a better chance, in order to help scale up these technology-based businesses that could create the jobs of tomorrow.
Javier Rolle, the new CEO of the hedge fund/asset manager CQS. Some speculate that he has been brought in to generate an IPO for that business to provide it with further growth opportunities. He says he's determined to grow that business organically. Watch this space. Equity markets around the world mixed today. The S&P trading at 27.73 right now. This is we await news tomorrow from the ECB. And then, of course, on Friday, we get US payrolls. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, 5:30 in the City of London. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio and on all of your Bloomberg devices. Quick run around the markets to give you an idea of what is going on. FTSE 100 finished up around 0.2%, 71.96. A little pick up in the auction process. Miners, the main reason why we had some strength there. The DAX trading lower. The auto stocks trending a little lower today. That's the reason for that. We've got Euro dollar trading at 1.13 ahead of tomorrow's ECB meeting. The expectation is that the star projections will deliver a significant downgrade when it comes to both inflation and growth. The S&P currently trading at 27.73, down by around 0.5%. Let's catch up on the headlines that you need to know. Charlie Taylor.
Hi, thank you very much. Lots going on. In addition to the ECB, of course, we've got the jobs report Friday in the United States this morning. A gloomy report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It said the global economy is suffering more than expected from trade tensions and political uncertainty, which are clouding prospects, particularly in Europe. IAG is working on expansion plans for its level low-cost arm after giving up on a bid for rival discounter Norwegian Air Shuttle. CEO Willie Walsh says British Airways parent IAG views the long-haul market as a fertile niche for no-frills carriers and is committed to expanding level. Burberry downgraded today to sell from neutral at Goldman Sachs, which cites the likely need for higher incremental investments to sustain broad momentum amid a turnaround of the British trench coat maker. Latest from the news desk, Jonathan Farrow, back to you.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much, sir. Cameron Christ joining us around the table here in New York, macro strategist for Bloomberg. You've run a few P&Ls in your time, Mr. Christ. Did you ever trade on OECD forecasts?
Hard no.
What do we learn from this? Why are they useful?
They generate content for news organizations.
Is that it? What was your attitude when one of these dropped across your desk? When the poor analysts brought it to you?
Well, to their
dear portfolio manager that I'm sure treated them very, very well.
No one would dare. That never happened. Well, I mean, it's kind of like ding, ding, ding. The last swimmer is in the pool now. So you know it's in the price when the IMF or the OECD mark down their forecast.
Why has the market been ignoring poor economic data?
Well, for one, obviously you've had a shift in the tilt of monetary policy towards easing, which presumably will offset some of that weakness. And I mean, when you talk about markets, what asset class are you referring
to? Okay, equities.
Equities. Well, yeah, I mean, listen, the starting point of the year was one where sort of a recession was in the price. And so, in a sense, we've taken a recession out of the price, but, I mean, year on year, we're up in the S&P, what, like 3% total return?
Total return, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
In terms of absolute return, year to date, the S&P is up 10%?
Yeah, okay, but it fell last year, right?
On a year-on-year basis, it's
low single digits. That doesn't strike me that the market is being necessarily overly optimistic. And hey, let's face it, the services ISM yesterday had the highest new orders in 14 years.
I mean, that number was just ridiculously good.
It was.
Where's that number come from?
People getting a lot of haircuts. I don't know. I don't know.
It's incredible how good that data point was, considering what is happening in the rest of the world right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, listen, it's the whole idea of services purchasing managers. It's a little odd, right?
I mean, it's like,
I love looking at the inventories on the services. What? I mean, it's not like the barber has
the jobs number, isn't it?
It's not like the barber has a closet full of haircuts that pile up if no one comes in.
I do like the way you've reduced the non-manufacturing ISM to the barbers across America.
It's the classic. The barber is the classic service industry.
I'm with you.
You look at it's the classic non-tradable, right? Because you can't. I mean, I guess conceivably you could import haircuts from China, but I'm not.
to Guy's very good point, the market has ignored hard data, has ignored some soft data, some weak data to be more precise, otherwise no one will know what I'm talking about. Some weak data. It's actually ignored some strong data too. This market's done nothing over the last couple of days, even with that really strong data point in the United States, even with a really good ADP print and some strong revisions too.
Yeah, although the revisions,
I'm with you, in line with the NFP, that's
the OECD forecast of economic data.
I'm with you, but you can see where Gar and I are going here.
Yeah, well, we reached some interesting technical levels on a number of indices, and after a good start to the year, it seems as if people are sort of ringing the register, booking some profit, and let's wait and see. We've gotten through earnings season, so. In terms of on a micro level, the catalysts aren't as significant as they have been over the last 5 or 6 weeks. On a macro level, yes, we've got economic data, but let's face it, it's kind of the trade story and the Fed that are driving the bus. And the trade stuff, I mean, Trump has kind of tried to drip feed the same story every day for about 3 weeks. And when you do that, eventually the marginal impact dries up, which is kind of where we are. And so now we're left to see, how is the Fed going to mark stuff to market? On Bloomberg Opinion, Bill Dudley, the former president of the New York Fed, wrote a piece, which I would agree with, saying you really shouldn't count the Fed out for the entire year. People seem to think that pause means done, and that isn't necessarily the case. So we've got the FOMC in 2 weeks from today. As looming as a potential macro catalyst. So if you think that there is a chance that they suggest that the rate cycle isn't totally done, well, perhaps that's not in the price. So it's another reason for circumspection.
Can I just ask you a question about what's happening in China?
Yes.
CSI on a 12-month basis is down by 4.5%. On a year-to-date basis, it's up kind of circa 30%. It's quite a bounce back and one that people are paying attention to. Tencent's up by some sort of 50%. I think it's the second biggest Asia listed stock that's out there. How do you, as a portfolio manager, how do you look at numbers like that and say, I don't know, entry points, exit points, how do you manage that kind of risk? The volatility is quite extreme.
Well, yeah, you can't look at the Chinese equity market in the same way as you would the S&P 500 or the FTSE or whatever, right? So you have to, in a sense, you have to volatility adjust it. But Insofar as you use sort of technical entry points and exit points, the chart is what the chart is. So, like for example, I know H shares, there was a reasonably significant level that we broke a couple of weeks ago, and that kind of spurred further gains. So that, you know, the scale might be different, but the shape of the line, as it were, is it should work. If it's going to work, it should work in the S&P and Chinese stocks, no matter what the scale on the right side of the chart is.
Speaking of levels, the S&P 500, 2800, just can't get through it, seemingly. We just roll back over.
Yeah.
275 on a 10-year seems to be this critical line in the sand now as well. Whenever we breach it, we just get sucked back down again.
Well, I mean, again, on the chart, 280 looks like the real significant level where we bounced off it earlier this year, and it was sort of a action reaction point around the turn of the year. So I think if we can get through 280, then it's kind of off to the races. But in the meantime, it's kind of just shuffling chairs on the deck of the Titanic.
Ken McCrice, macro strategist for Bloomberg, sticking with us. Next up on the program, we'll get our teeth into the FX market, the dollar strength story, or should I say, dollar resilience story, that not many people saw coming. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, 5:40 in the city of London. Cameron Cries joining us in New York. Well, I say he's joining us. He's joining John in New York. We talked earlier on, Cameron, about the ECB. Just give us your two cents worth, it's the ECB, about what you think is going to happen tomorrow and how big a bind the central bank is in.
Well, clearly they're going to mark down the forecast that, as you alluded to earlier, there have been some leaks, as you often find with the ECB.
Are they leaks or trial balloons?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, is there a difference?
Well, I just wonder whether this was really a trial balloon, just to see what the price action, the move would
look
like.
Well, I mean, it's been kind of in the narrative for a while now that they're thinking about a new round of TLTROs. The leak, the trial balloon, is that they're talking about it, but probably aren't ready to proceed tomorrow. So what that tells you that's new, I'm not quite sure, because I think that's broadly speaking where the market is. You know, there's kind of, when there's this much smoke, somewhere there's going to be a fire. So it seems as if it's just a matter of time before they unveil this policy. Is it going to work? Well, it depends on what the object of the policy is. Is if it's to spur bank lending in Europe, then the answer is no. If it's to weaken the currency, which I suspect is the real answer, then the answer is possibly.
That's interesting. You think it's to weaken the currency? The currency's
been
in a really tight range of late. It didn't break out today. How dovish do they have to be to get this currency to break below its recent range?
Well, I mean, maybe if they implement the TLTROs, that will be the thing. I'm not sure.
We saw that today, and the market is still within the range. The euro initially dipped and then came straight back up again.
Well,
that's got to be in the price then.
Well, bear in mind also, Guy, that the U.S. posted its biggest trade deficit in more than a decade this morning as well, right? So that's a competing influence, and it's actually the story, I think, of foreign exchange this year.
You think so?
Or, you know, over the last year or so, is you've got these two competing forces. On the one hand, the relative external balances, the U.S. trade deficit, current account deficit, the European surplus, argue that the euro should be about 150. But then you've got the relative policy mix. In the U.S., you've got loose fiscal and, relatively speaking, tight monetary policy. In Europe, you've got tight fiscal and relatively loose monetary policy. Those suggest that the euro should be 90 or 80 or something like that. And so you could argue that there are multiple equilibria. If the market were exclusively focused on external balances, the euro would be a hell of a lot higher. If the market were exclusively focused on the policy mix, the euro would be a hell of a lot lower. But we're kind of caught between the Scylla and Charybdis, the rock and the hard place of those two competing forces.
What do you
make
of the argument that we're building up a bit of a carry trade in the U.S. dollar, the funding currencies of choice being the yen, the euro, and in G10 that the dollar is the high-yielding currency? What do you make of that?
I'm not sure if I buy it in the sense that if that were the case, we would probably see it through the basis swaps in the sense of you'd see dollar rates moving sharply one way or the other in the FX funding markets, and it hasn't really been the case so far this year. There was a big correction at the end of last year, but so far this year, it's been no real discernible trend. In fact, I think people were on balance leaning towards selling dollars early doors, precisely on the notion that the Fed is sort of pulling back, abandoning ship, and that's bearish the dollar. And I mean, clearly that didn't work. But I mean, listen, in the grand scheme of things, we've gone nowhere so far this year in the euro.
Dead flat.
And I think it probably makes sense from a tactical perspective not to spend too much powder until the price kind of tells you which narrative is going to win out.
Hey, Cameron, great to catch up with you. Cameron Kreis, Bloomberg's very own and one of our best. Next up on the program, Cameron mentioned that op-ed, the opinion piece on Bloomberg Opinion by the former New York Fed President Bill Dudley. Caught up with him a little bit earlier. I'll bring you some of that interview up next. You're listening to Bloomberg. This is The Cable.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, 5:48 in the City of London. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio and on all of your Bloomberg devices. John Ferrow over in New York. I'm Guy Johnson joining him here in London. John, two main things on deck in the next 48, 72 hours. We've got the ECB rate decision coming out tomorrow. We will, of course, bring this to you live. And then, of course, we'll bring you the press conference as well with Mario Draghi from Frankfurt. The expectation is, and certainly there seems to have been some leaks in advance of this, that there will be a significant downgrading of both inflation and growth projections when it comes to the staff economic forecasts. How will Draghi respond to that? Will we see further funding for the Eurozone banks in the form of another TLTRO? Then, of course, we get to the main event out of the United States on Friday, which, of course, is the payrolls. John?
So much coming up, Guy. Really fortunate that we actually got to catch up with the former New York Fed President Bill Dudley coming into payrolls Friday, who has written for Bloomberg Opinion in the last 24 hours saying, don't assume the Fed is done raising interest rates. Take a listen to what Mr. Dudley had to say.
There's quite a bit of distance between the last summer economic projections and what the market currently thinks. I think the key question is, when the Fed says they're patient, does that mean they're done? And I think the answer is, not necessarily. I think what's going to happen is we're going to have a pretty weak first quarter, and that's going to probably reinforce the idea that the Fed is done. But I think the economy is going to pick up steam after that. Some of the issues that were holding the economy back, like the tightening of financial conditions that we saw in the fourth quarter, the questions about Chinese growth, the uncertainties about trade policy, I think those things are going to be resolved mainly positively in the first half of the year. So I think Fed tightening may be back on the table in the second half of 2019.
So, Bill, over the last couple of months, the Federal Reserve has come under some criticism about the way it's communicated its change towards a position of patience. How does the Federal Reserve refine its communication in the coming months to adjust and guide the market towards the reality you just described?
Well, I think the Fed has tried to get the market to focus less on what it says about its own projections and more about the economic outlook. The economic outlook is what's going to drive the Fed. And what changed in the fourth quarter was we had a lot of new developments. Financial conditions tightened, growth abroad slowed, there were uncertainties about trade policy, and inflation was, you know, very quiescent. The unemployment rate stopped declining, even though payroll growth was strong. So there was a whole bunch of factors that pushed the Fed in the direction of being patient. Whether those factors persist or not will determine whether, in fact, patience means done.
Well, Bill, it's been quite difficult recently to get an understanding of the Fed's reaction function because there's been a lot of discussion about allowing for an overshoot on the inflation target of in and around 2%. In your mind, is this a Fed that's willing to tolerate a bit of an overshoot? And how does that complicate things? If you say to the market we're data dependent, but the market doesn't know how you're dependent on the data.
Well, I think the discussion about inflation is really a longer-term issue about do they want to move away from their current policy, which is a bygones policy. In other words, if they miss inflation below 2% for a long period of time, their next move is to try to get back to 2%, not above 2%. That's the current policy. They're now having discussions about whether that's not the right policy because that might lead inflation expectations to decline over time. So they're thinking about refining their inflation objectives. But that's different. That's not going to happen right in the very near term. They're going on a big project over the next 6 to 12 months to evaluate whether their inflation targeting regime is the proper one. I think in the near term, it's really going to be about growth, pressure on resources, and whether that shows up in any inflation pressure. I think the Fed is going to be tolerant of inflation slightly above 2%. But if they think the economy has a lot of momentum, if they think inflation is going to keep climbing, then they're going to start to tighten again.
You're just joining us, William Dudley, a Bloomberg opinion piece. Don't assume that the Fed is done raising rates. That, according to Bill Dudley. Dr. Dudley, on paragraph 7, you do what you do best, which is hide your mathematics. You talk about threshold effects, and you also talk about inertial force, the physics of monetary policy. Where is the inertial force right now in our monetary policy?
Well, it takes a bit of information for the Fed to sort of change its mind. So we had a lot of evidence in the fourth quarter that pushed the Fed off the notion of continuing to tighten in the near term.
Right.
Now it's going to take that evidence reversing, quite a bit of reversal, before the Fed starts to decide to tighten again. So if you look at the Fed monetary policy through history, the Fed doesn't move erratically. They don't go up and then down, up and then down. They tend to move in sort of cycles. And that sort of shows you that there's threshold effects to get them to move in one direction or the other. And once they start moving, it takes quite a bit of information to get them to stop. And once they've stopped, it takes quite a bit of information to get them to move again.
Bill, can we just take the opportunity to lift the lid on the decision-making process at the FOMC? Whenever we have guests come into radio with Tom and I to see how the sausage is made, they're always surprised by how messy it really is. And largely because of what Tom and I are doing behind the scenes. It's very messy, Tom. I'm just wondering how messy it is at the FOMC because the market is literally gripping on every, hanging on every single word you guys put out.
What happens
in a
around the table at the Eccles building? Come on, Bill. We're among friends here.
How do you how do you decide on the word? Everyone's going to go out there and talk about patience. Patience is our new word.
Do you guys sing Kumbaya?
Patience means what it says. I mean, it means I'm going to be slow to do anything. It doesn't mean I'm done.
But you sit around the table, Bill, and decide that that's the word you're all going to go out and trot around for the next month or so. Talk me through the decision-making process.
Well,
how do you guys come up with
it? These words are not chosen lightly. I mean, if you see something that's in a speech or in the chair's press conference, those words are very carefully chosen. If someone is speaking extemporaneously, then you can discount those words a little bit because people obviously can't be quite as precise when they're speaking than when they're writing. So the words are very important. Fed is picking those words with care and careful deliberation. And it's also words that are picked that they're socialized across the committee. I mean, typically the chair wants the committee to be together.
Right.
And so there's going to be some discussion about are these kind of words the words that are appropriate or not.
New York Fed President, the former New York Fed President, Bill Dudley there, running for a Bloomberg Opinion now. What a lineup we have, a Bloomberg Opinion in a piece titled, Don't Assume the Fed is Done Raising Rates. Take a look at that. Guy and I will be back with you tomorrow to run you through full reaction from the ECB decision and news conference with President Draghi and get you set up for the following day for Payrolls Friday. A lot still to come this week from New York and London. This was The Cable. This is Bloomberg Radio.